Okay, please join me in extending a warm welcome to our special guest tonight, who is Charlie C. from the Pacific Group in Los Angeles.
Hi, my name is Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank my friend Chris for inviting me back here to do this. It's always an honor to be asked to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it's always an honor to be asked back, which is certainly an odd occurrence for anybody who drinks to be invited anywhere twice. And I like, this is a great meeting. This is I like the way you sweat the new people to identify, you know, just waiting on the section. I was going to jump up and say I was new just to take the heat off. I was, you know, because you know, the new, I know how I was when they would say, okay, anybody in this section in their first 30 days, and you're sitting there going, should I or shouldn't I? Should I or shouldn't I? And they just hold the gaze on you until finally, all right, I admit, I give up, you know, because we all know. So just say it. It's not going to, because if you don't say it, we'll make you feel really bad. And but that's great. That was the most important thing I said when I was new, was that I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe it when I came to my first meeting. I thought I was just had bursts of enthusiasm followed by months of remorse and self-loathing. But it didn't have anything to do with alcohol. It was just you. And I came to find out that I that there was something wrong. I start out slow and then kind of roll to a shattering climax, so be patient. For those of you who are new, we don't get paid to do this. You're going to find out why in about 3 minutes. I'm an alcoholic. That's the extent of my issues. You can put a period at the end of that sentence. That's it. I am an alcoholic. I thought that there were other things, other shadings of what's wrong with me, that it wasn't just alcoholic. That's for you. I can see you're alcoholic and that you need to do these simple steps because you look like simple folk. But I am a little more, I have several more gradations of sophistication and conflict than you do. See, I don't process it as obviously as you do, and therefore I'm probably not just an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic with other colorations, you know. No one would ever listen to me say that until now. But I didn't drink like you did. I never, you know. I love the stories I used to hear in AA. I love the stories I hear now. But I really loved it when I was new to hear all the crash and burn stories. You know, the people being disarmed at meetings and stuff. And that was just exciting to me because I couldn't whip my own ass when I was new. I was pretty much a dork from the start and have evolved into being an older dork. But I was just a dorky colt when I was new. And I had no idea what the story was here. I had no idea what was happening to me or what was happening in what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I thought it was an embarrassing punchline in a Johnny Carson monologue. You know, it was just a Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, dear God, how did I ever get here? That's what I'm here to tell you tonight. And I started out, I had a difficult childhood like most of us did. Both of my parents loved me. And if you are, I mean, that's not to diminish people who had difficult childhoods where their parents beat them up and stuff, but I got to tell you something. Being loved has its own set of problems. Because especially if you're an alcoholic, when people tell me they love me, I don't know how to react. I don't know. It seems to me that there's a transaction going on in which I don't understand my part in it. So I do like any self-respecting alcoholic. I just say, I love you too, and then walk away thinking, why did I say that? What was that all about? And my parents were you know, I was an only child. My dad was a carpenter, and my mom was, as I like to say, a humble virgin woman. And I think I woke up on the wrong side of the manger a few times. But I was just cranky and irascible, I guess, right around 5. Up until 5, it seemed like everything was fine, according to the family pictures. And then at 5, I started to look like the potential assassin in the family. I was the black hole of any family gathering, you know, because my dad was one of 15 kids, and we would have family get-togethers that were just. I should backtrack a little. I go all over the place, so forgive me, but I don't like people. Not you, them. You know who they are. And if you're sitting there wondering who they are, you're probably one of them. But even the newest newcomer knows who they are, because they're out to get you, and we're here to protect you from them. But my dad had all these kids in the family, and they reproduced. I mean, I don't have to explain that to you. It's not a biology class. But we'd go to these family get-togethers, and it was just small talk and chitter-chatter and how you doing, and all my cousins seemed to be really athletic, and you can take one look at me and know that my Heisman days are ahead of me. But I didn't know how to react to these people. They all told, oh, here he comes. Look, you've grown up since the last time I saw you. Well, yeah, you know, okay. I have a tendency not to shrink, but I didn't know how to have small talk. I don't like small talk simply because of the nature of the size, I guess, but I just don't get into it. I don't know what to say after, how's it going, big guy? I don't follow sports, so I'm lost on you there. Unless you want to know who the lineup was for the Jefferson Airplane in 1967, I really don't know much else except my opinion. But I just hated being there, and I hated being in family stuff. And the problem I have with disliking the human race is that I demand its approval at the same time. Not just approval. I would like adoration, if at all possible. But I don't like people. But I need their adoration. But I hate them. You can see where you start to get a sense of torque in your life from this kind of thing. It actually will propel you forward. And I just always have felt uncomfortable around people. And I was perfectly content sitting by myself and listening to music or reading a book or reading comic books. I didn't know how to relate to my parents. They were older than I was older than other kids' parents by about 15 years. My dad and mom didn't have me till they were in their late 30s. And of course, as proof that there is a God, I had my first child at 49, my second one at 50, and was the elderly father at the Lamaze class that was being helped to my feet by the young dads after the breathing exercise. Jesus, let me go. That was tough. But my parents just seemed awkward, and my dad was a hick, and my dad had about a fifth grade education, and my mom didn't have much more than that, and they just seemed like, you know that feeling, just, oh, no, and they say, we want to make you happy and provide for you. Oh, God, don't lay that on me. And I was sickly, and I had asthma, and I'm telling you all this stuff because it just made me more and more isolated from people, and more resentful of people who seemed to have it easier than I did, the ones who were easy in conversation, who seemed to have lots of friends, who would go to school and make friends the first week. I went to school for 12 years, and I would make a friend, and then they would get another friend, and I felt like I'd been cheated on, and then I wouldn't talk to them anymore, and school was exhausting because they demand things of you. And I just hated everything. I just didn't like anything about life, really. And I didn't know it at the time. Only after being sober for a while did I really start to understand that. And I just knew I was uncomfortable with people. I got to go through my childhood a little bit here. It's not therapy, but you'll understand. I had potential. They don't tell people who are actually using their potential that they have it. They only tell people they have potential who have it unused in large portion. Much of my potential I have retained to this evening. but somewhat less than when I got here. But I was being hauled into principal's offices and priest's offices and teacher's offices and high school counselor's offices and plunked down with my parents who were, you know, they didn't have any education. They were kind of, all their hopes were riding on me. And this person would sit there with a big folder and say, you know, Charles has a lot of potential. We just don't understand why he's not doing anything with it. And my reaction was always the same. I know I've got potential. My parents clearly know I have potential now, thanks a bundle. You know I've got potential. And just for the record, I'll use my potential when I am goddamn good and ready to use it, and not even that much sooner. When I do use it, I hope you've got sunglasses on, Skipper, because I'm going to light you up. But until then, maybe you can take your idiotic concern for my potential and go wipe it on one of the other saps at this school, because if you were such hot stuff, you wouldn't be a high school counselor now, would you? It never came out in exactly those words. I said something like, I'll try harder. But I... But I always felt that way inside, that sense of just anger, because even at my own fault, and it made me hate myself, and it had nothing to do with them. It was just one more reason that I could validate what I felt about myself. I didn't know it at the time. And anything, for you who are new in this program, what you hear from AA podiums was not experienced in real time. We weren't having these revelations while it was happening. They were buried. It's like Alcoholics Anonymous, by going to meetings, doing the steps, working with other people, working with a sponsor, being part of the fellowship, my story gradually started to take shape because I understood what happened to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is sort of like the black box after an airline disaster, you know? While it's happening, you don't really understand it. And then you get here and they go, well, let's crack open the black box and see what's in there. And then you start going, oh, my God, you know? And then you have a choice, whether you just want to shut the box and go back in and fly the way you used to, or try to change. And that's what the program is all about. But I was angry and frustrated, and I got out of high school when I was 17 and went right into college and graduated at 30. We were talking about that dinner tonight. Had no fun in college. None. Not even that much. I wanted to be a writer because it looked easy. And... it was the Tet Offensive in 1968, and I got a lucky break. I got a good lottery number in 1969. I registered for the draft and did all that stuff, but I didn't have to go serve in Vietnam. You would think somebody would take a break like that. My father was an 8-year Marine Corps veteran, drill instructor, and he thought I should serve. And I went down and I went down and took my physical and was 1A, you know. And then the next year they had the lottery, and I got a good number, and I didn't have to serve. I should have parlayed that into something. But instead I went right into the music industry as a clerk in a record store. And it was while I was there on the launching pad of my success that a bunch of guys came in who had been sort of the hoodlums at my school, and they asked me if I wanted to go to a party. And I thought, no, I don't actually want to go to a party because I've never been to a party before. Never went to a party in high school. Didn't want to go to a party then because, as I understood it, there would be people at the party, and that's not going to do. But I said, okay, and I went. I got my buddy John, who was my best buddy, and we went to this party. And John was like the opposite of me. He had girls after him all the time. I was always one. I was like, I've been on hormone alert since I was about 8. I love women. I adore women. But it's like watching a chihuahua chase a school bus. You know, what's he going to do when he catches it? I don't know what to do. I'm inept. But John had women that he just trailed women, you know, and he was a drummer in a band. And so I just hung around and tried to catch the overflow. And I was missing it for some reason. But we went to this party, and I stood there at this party, and I was grinding because one more time, my suspicions and my expectations were being satisfied that the human race was as pathetic as I thought it was. It was a big house in Santa Ana, California, a big Victorian house. Everybody, there were probably 200 people at this party, half the room was drunk and the other half was on acid. The MC5 was playing on the stereo, and they all thought they were having a conversation. There were people in various stages of sexual union throughout the house, and I was standing there by myself grinding on the fact that this is exactly what I hate about people. They don't elevate the human experience. I read Great Expectations. I saw, talk about a great title for an alcoholic to enjoy. I thought people should behave nobly, should behave better than this, this animalistic jungle fervor going on in here. It's disgusting. It's exactly the reason why I don't want to be around people. They're just degenerate. They're vulgar and they're crass. And they have to get drunk and stoned to talk to each other. And I'm standing there grinding on this, and somebody came by and handed me a can of malt liquor. And I thought, oh, great. I get to join the crowd? Be part of the soiree? And I opened it, and I drank about half of this can of malt liquor while I was standing there grinding on my fate because John had driven. And about halfway through that can of malt liquor, it occurred to me that I've been way too hard on you people. It occurred to me, in fact, that you were becoming much more interesting than you had just moments earlier, that I was feeling more open to what was happening with you. I was feeling loose, pleased, joyful. I had a sense of being in the moment for the first time in my life, where it seemed like, because I lived my life raging about what had happened in the past and what was going on around me, and fearful of what's going to happen tomorrow, and frustrated that I know it's not going to get any better. And at that moment, when I drank that can of malt liquor, I felt like I was there, just in the middle of the moment with all the... It wasn't like I had a brick wall between me and humanity. It was like I had some albumin-like substance that I kept trying to get part of the experience of being human, and I could never get through it. The more I pushed at it, the more it just moved with me. But when I drank, that evaporated, and I felt like I was actually there amongst people, full of... And it was going to... And being there, for me, is the knowledge and the anticipation that things are going to get better in about a half an hour. Oh, my God. I felt like this is wonderful. I thought if you'd flip the lights out in that room, I would have started radiating joy. And so I had another can of malt liquor, because you can't just... you can't pay the rent on one can if you want to stay there. And I was absolutely floored at the experience I was having with two cans of malt liquor. And I thought, my God, this is exactly how I'm supposed to feel. I'm not supposed to feel like I felt when I first got here. This is how human beings feel. This sense of anticipation and joy and accepting things as they are. I was alive for a change when I drank that malt liquor that night. I went into a blackout and wound up at the end of the evening. John wanted to leave, and I was hanging onto the door handle of his car, running alongside the car and vomiting all over myself and just laughing my ass off because I'd been there. And I'll tell you something, that is the great paradox of alcoholism, is that I have never forgotten that moment. I have never forgotten what a quantity of alcohol will in my system, will, how it makes me feel. And I will forget all the consequences of the ensuing 12 years to remember that moment when I was there, and those moments when alcohol made me feel like a person for a change instead of some frustrated, spent, unfulfilled, restless, irritable, discontented person. Once I got alcohol in me, everything felt better, and you looked better. And it was really important that you looked better, because then I could interact with you. And I felt like a man, you know, like a man is supposed to feel, not like some brittle dick. And which is, I mean, I know we're in a church, but I'm sure even God thought that. It didn't get any better for the next 12 years. Let me put it that way. I've got the most boring drunkalog in Alcoholics Anonymous, truly. I drank. I got sick. I've heard your stories. I love them. I personally have never come out of a blackout yelling, cover me, I'm going in. But I've heard people say, I came out of a blackout going, okay, cut the red wire. I thought, wow, you know. I've heard all the fireballing cars on New Year's Eve stories and all that stuff, but that didn't happen to me. And I never came out of a blackout saying much of anything. I've come out of blackouts a lot with people saying things to me, like, boy, I bet that hurt. I fell a lot. I'm one of those alcoholics who believes the fastest way down a long flight of stairs is just relax. Nature will take its course. And I drank, and I drank, and I built a reality for myself with alcohol. Alcohol became the way I could identify myself. Not openly, but it just... George Orwell, I quote this because it's the only thing I can quote. I have no brain cells. I can't remember anything. But I live next to a guy named Chuck G down in L.A., right in the same vicinity. And Chris had to remind me of his name today. So I can tell you, I have no brain cells left. But it just made me feel alive. You know, and Orwell, I quote Orwell, he said in one of his stories that the tyrant wears a mask and his face grows to fit it. And I think that qualifies for alcoholics too, that when I was not drinking, before I ever drank, I had a mask of what I wanted you to believe I was rather than what I really was. And I held that out there for you to look at, and I didn't believe a word of it. I just knew you were going to find out about me. And then I drank, and the alcohol filled the gap between what's going on in here and the back of that mask, and I really believed that what I was holding out there was the real me. This is me. This is who I am. And the alcohol made me feel as if I was going to do it. And I was, but not today. But I was actually going to launch myself into something, but just not at the moment. I'm getting ready. I'm on the launching pad. I'm like a little kid with those little cars, those little friction cars that they push on the ground. That was how I was about life. Oh, man, look at this. Look at this thing go. It's going to take off when I put it down. When I finally let this thing go, stand back, world. I'm just not going to let it go today, you know, and that's how I live my life with, you know, my foot on the gas, pedal to the metal in park. And I drank regularly. I'm a daily drinker. I'm a drunk driver. I take no smug pride in that. Just down the street when we were driving up here, there's a plaque for something about not driving drunk, and it had a girl's name on it. You know, I was spared the grief of having something like that happen, but I wasn't spared because I was blessed. I was spared because I was lucky. Had I stayed out there longer, something like that might have happened. I read about today in Los Angeles, yesterday, a highway patrol officer sitting on his motorcycle at a red light got rear-ended by a drunk guy and killed. You know, a father of five kids. And that could have easily been me. It could have easily been you. And the fact that we're here is not because God has blessed us to stay sober, but it's because we're lucky. You know, we're lucky to be here. We're lucky to have stopped it right now, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But so I drank, and I got married, and I thought that would make me feel like a whole human because eventually the stuff starts to come back off the mask. And by the 11th of June of 1981, I was holding that mask out there for everything I could put behind it. And I was angry and fearful and threatened and delusional and sick physically, mentally, and spiritually. And I was as drunk as I've ever been in my life. And I couldn't hold that mask up anymore. You know, and I went to I was married, and my wife apparently got tired of being the only participant. I don't have a problem with relationships up to the point. I'm pretty good at relationships, actually, up to the point where another person's introduced. Then I got a fold. But we had a difficult time, and she loved me, which was partly her responsibility, I think. But She was not alcoholic. She'd try to drink with me. That was a joy. After about two glasses of wine, she'd start fanning herself. Woo, I got to stop. I'm losing control. And I thought, well, you know, that's the problem. You're a quitter. That's the difference between you and me. I mean, you're drinking and you're losing control. See, I drink and I start to feel some control over my life. It's when I don't drink that I feel like everything inside of me eventually is going to start flying around and just disintegrate into the atmosphere. And I got sicker and sicker and cut everybody away from my life. That's just a speedball through this. I just snipped the little moorings that we all have in our lives of family and friends and relationships just to preserve the right to drink the way I wanted to drink. Because nothing made me feel more... I mean, I would sacrifice friendships, family, whatever, for the solace that 3 ounces of bourbon would bring me, you know. And that was just the start. And when I started, I didn't know where I was going to stop. And I you know, I'm an IV sleeping, drive on the rims kind of a drunk. And I had a car that looked like me when I got sober. It had about two square inches of paint left on it. It was an old 67 Volkswagen that had no reverse, and I had to park it on a hill with no one in front of me. Every night, I would find a place to park it on the hill rather than get the reverse fixed, which seemed like a big hassle. It was a lot easier every night of my life to find a hill to park on with no one in front of me. And my life was like that. It was scotch taped together. I didn't think I had a problem. I use the story not because I have a neighbor across the street. I had a neighbor across the street. His name was Tom. Tom was a great neighbor, not an alcoholic. He and his wife and their two kids lived across the street from me, and their kids are the same, pretty much the same age as my children. And a couple of years ago, Tom started having some abdominal problems. He was in his 40s, and he was a set builder at a bunch of the studios. And he went in to get checked out, and he had pancreatic cancer. And he went in for surgery about 2 weeks later. And I went over, I talked to his wife on the street, and I said, well, how did the surgery go for Tom? And she said, well, it went as could be expected. And I said, well, did they get the cancer? And she said, well, that's not why they did the surgery. And I said, well, why did they do the surgery if they weren't trying to get the cancer? And she said, they were taking away parts of other organs so the tumor would have a place to grow, so that he would not be in excruciating pain and he can live through the holidays and be with the children before he dies. So they took away parts of his stomach and other pieces of his insides, perfectly good areas, to allow the tumor to grow so that it wouldn't cause him too much pain. And I thought, and I mean no disrespect to him, and I do not mean to trivialize his death by saying this, but is that not exactly what alcoholics do in their own lives? We cut away perfectly healthy things to allow the disease to grow. We just cut good people out of our lives. We cut good jobs out of our lives. We cut usefulness out of our lives. We cut responsibility out of our lives. All the decent things that were in me that my parents gave me and worked hard to provide for me, I just threw away for the right to say, no, that's not what I believe. I believe that if I can drink a little bit, I will get myself together and then I'll be able to get started again. But I never could, and I just got more and more pathetic. And I wound up on the 11th of June of 1981. I was living, at first I lived with my wife in a house, and then I lived in a converted garage in West Los Angeles where I could drink by myself. I was delighted to get out of that marriage and live in this converted garage. Here we go, you know, fire up the band. And I lived there for a while. Then I thought, hey, she can get out if she, you know, and I went back and made her move out of the house, and I lived there. And then I wound up living at my mother's house, which is really chick bait. And my mom had moved out, and I was living there, you know, and was a mess. And it was $120 a month, or about $118 a month mortgage payment on this house, and I was 4 months behind on it because, well, you know, that's a lot of scratch to pull together when you're drinking. at one time, $118. You got to be kidding me for this house. And so I was about to lose the house, and I went to a meditation retreat that my therapist was throwing because I was going to therapy at that point, which was not going well, really. One of the prerequisites of therapy success being truth. And I will say this, that as a drinking alcoholic hasn't got the slightest clue what the truth is. You know, we just don't know. It's not that we're bad or we're trying to run from the truth. We've just constructed so many layers of lies to justify drinking that the truth is an abstraction. My truth is just, this is what I'm going to be something someday, but tonight I'm going to drink. That's the truth. I will be something someday. I will be successful, and you'll all be sorry if I don't kill myself before then. Then you'll be sorry in a different way. But anyway, I'll win, you know, because you'll be sorry. As long as you're sorry, I win, you know. Because you are sorry, and you will be sorrier, you know. And then, oh, hi, Mom, you know, that kind of thing. And can I borrow $300? I'm about to lose your house. So I went to a meditation retreat, and while I was there, I had what I believe was an intervention by a higher power that I couldn't explain at the time. I was ready to commit suicide there, which was certainly not my point in going to a meditation retreat. I was actually going there to get spiritual and wound up looking for a tree that would bear my weight. And it's easy for you to laugh, but it was certainly the apex of my life. And I sat there out on this meditation grounds in Montecito, California, just south of Santa Barbara. And I sat there one afternoon, and I thought, I want to die. I don't want to live anymore. I don't want any drama. I don't want a big deal about it. I just wish that somehow I could just evaporate. I want to be like Robert Frost said, and just, you know, not like he said, but like he prayed not to be, and that is to grab the end of a branch and pull it down and grab the tree and fling myself off the earth, just disappear, you know, and go away, because I am of no use to anybody. I'm of no use to anyone. I'm of no use to myself, and I couldn't come up with another lie for that day to myself to play the game that tomorrow was going to be better. I just hit the wall with the lies and just thought, I'm done. I want to die, and I can't kill myself. I couldn't do it. Whatever it took, whether it's courage or cowardice, I don't know, and I can't judge that, but I could not kill myself. And while I'm sitting there, I thought, now what? Now what? I can't die, and I don't want to live. What next? I can't drink anymore. I'm sick. I'm physically sick. I've been peeing blood for months. By this time in publishing, I was a receiving clerk at a bookstore, and I was working there, and my student helpers were coming up, and they're going, are you all right? Because your eyes are getting yellow. You know, and I was bloated, and I was sick. I was just physically sick. I had psoriasis so bad that I could almost vacuum my sheets in the morning. You know, it was like I'd get up, and there'd be like the Shroud of Turin on my own bed, my own outline, you know, enough DNA in there to create a whole family. But I just wanted to die. You know, I was sick. And while I was feeling that sense of despair, and it wasn't even self-pity. It was way beyond self-pity. It was just despair. And I thought, I felt inside for about 30 seconds completely and unreservedly loved. All the way to the bottom of my soul, I felt completely at peace and loved. And then that lasted about 30 seconds, and it went away. And I thought, what has happened to me? What's happening to me? I don't know what that is. And I just burst into tears. I sat there and cried for about 4 hours on this meditation grounds. And I went home from there just shattered from the experience. And that was on the 11th of June of 1981. That's the last time I've had a drink or anything. That was it. That was the end of the road for me. I didn't know it at the time. And I went home from there. And now my wife, who was I was getting a divorce from at that point, when we were first going together, well, our second date, her therapist told her not to go out with me anymore. So we moved in together the next month. And by the time we had lived together for a while, she came in and said, I thought if we were going to live together that we'd want to get married. And I said, okay, if you want. That, I, the old romantic in me. And so we were together, and her brother came over. Now, her brother Bob had been in about 4 hospitals for alcoholism. He had been in nut houses. This is back in the early 70s, mid-70s, and he was institutionalized several times for drinking, and he could not hold a job. And Bob came over, and we hit it off like that. I got a bottle of Jack Daniels, like a big quart of it, and we started drinking. We got about halfway through that, and I look over, and there's my wife-to-be giving me one of these at the door of the bedroom. And I had to say, excuse me, Bob, I'll be right back. I go in there and shut the door, and she says, she had tears in her eyes. She said, stop giving Bob alcohol. Bob is an alcoholic. And I said, Bob is no more an alcoholic than I am. You are a nag. Why don't you back it up, sister? And I just walked back out. Okay, Bob, where were we? You know, and we drank and laughed and scratched the rest of the night, had a good time. And 2 weeks later, Bob was dead. Bob was 25 years old. He was my age. He had a 5-year-old daughter. And he got drunk, or was drinking one day apparently, and went into Lake Castaic and just north of Los Angeles and went in the water and never came out. He was a strong swimmer, one of the most handsome men I've ever met, and just had everything going for him. He had a lot of potential. And he drowned and left an estranged wife and his baby behind. And I went and got his car and his clothes and drove it back to Los Angeles. And no one ever talked about alcoholism. No one talked about drinking. No one talked about anything. Just what a tragedy that Bob had this accident. And the day, 4 days after I'd had that experience at the meditation retreat, my mother-in-law called me and said, Debbie's getting out of detox tomorrow. Can you take her to an AA meeting? Debbie was Bob's widow. This is about 6 years later. And so I thought, sure. So I went to get her. Now, mind you, the second day of my sobriety, I'd forgotten how to walk. I literally was at work, and I could not remember how to walk. I had to sit down for about a half an hour. My legs are going, you know, every which way. And I sat and just sat there for a while and waited and waited and tried to remember, okay, left foot, right foot. It was ridiculous. I was having auditory hallucinations from the back seat of my car. People going, Charlie. I heard Steely Dan Asia going around in my stereo. It hadn't been connected for months, but I could hear that album playing in the car. I would sing with it. And while I was twitching and Charlie, you know, I was driving home and trying to find a hill, Charlie, and Asia, and I was out of my mind. And then my mother-in-law calls and says, can you give Debbie a ride to an AA meeting? Oh, yeah, I'm a candidate for driving somebody to an AA meeting. Yeah, I'll give the kid a ride. That's what I thought. Oh, yeah, I'll help her out. I'll be happy to help her. I was also having those visual hallucinations where you get, I don't know if anybody else in here has experienced it. I know a couple people I've met have, where you get those little gnats that appear in your peripheral vision that just hover there like this, and the minute you turn to look at them, they're gone. You know? And then you start focusing on something else, and whoosh, back they go, and right there. And they're just around like this, and all I could do was go like this to get rid of them, you know? So I'd go to work, and I'd be talking to people and going like this, you know, and, you know, trying to twitch around. And I was just having a problem. I was a little jangly. And so I went, in that condition, I went to get Debbie to take her to her AA meeting. Debbie had 22 days of sobriety. And on the way to that AA meeting, it was about a 25-minute drive, and she 12-stepped me. Who knows what happens? I mean, I saw something different in her that I didn't see before. She looked different. She acted differently. She was grounded, sane, alive. She had something in her eyes that I couldn't put a finger on. So I was going to drive her to her AA meeting because I figured if it was working for her, great. And she talked to me and said, I told her I quit drinking, trying to, you know, just to show her that it's not all hopeless,
Charlie.
Don't turn around and give them the satisfaction of paying attention to them. They're, who? Never mind. They're just back there. So I pull up to the curb, and I said, I'll pick you up in about an hour, hour and a half. And she said, well, why don't you come in? She said, if you quit drinking, this might help you too. I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but I've drunk with you, and maybe this will help you. And we'd been drunk together. She'd seen me in action. And so I parked my car where I could go forward after the meeting and went into the AA meeting. And I did exactly what some people tonight did. You know, your first anybody in their first week of sobriety, they said, would you please stand up and identify yourself by your name and the nature of your disease? And I thought, oh, disease? I don't have a disease. I drink a bit, but I don't have any kind of disease at all. And I'm in sunglasses. I got a deerstalker hat on. It's about 112 outside, and I got a wool jacket and a sweater vest on, my shirt buttoned to my neck. I got a mustache and shoulder-length hair, and I'm rocking on my heels in the back of the meeting, going like this, and getting really annoyed when people would come up and go, hi, are you new? And I'd go, no, I'm not new. I got 4 days. You know? I'm not new. I haven't had a drink in 4 days. You know, I thought new was you were drunk when you crossed the threshold of the meeting. I got 4 days. It's been the hardest 4 damn days of my entire life. So I'd appreciate it if you would take your little smirk and go use it on somebody else. And people gave me their phone numbers. Wow. We came back. We went out for coffee after the meeting. We're going to go out for coffee. Let's go for a coffee. Oh, well, nothing could make me happier since I've been, you know, I got dragged around. They took me around that meeting. You know, okay, hey, Charlie, did you get a big book? I thought, a what? A big book. How big a book you talking about? I mean, I work in a bookstore, and we got a shitload of big books in there. If it's not bigger than Gardner Art Through the Ages, it's not really that big a book, to tell you the truth. But we'll come up and get our big book. I thought, well, does the big book have a title? I looked at, oh, this is called Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, the big book. Maybe I'll go and get some more brown drink. You know, so I said, okay, I'll get the big book. And I said, how much is it? And they said, well, it's $5. And I thought, I reached in my pocket, and of course I had $3. And the lady who was the literature chairperson there said, that's okay. Here, take a dollar. Take a dollar for the basket. I'll take the two. People will buy you coffee afterward. Don't have to worry about that. And then if you ever get the money, pay me back the $3. That's fine. You don't have to worry about it. Take the book. I thought, great, okay, okay. I walked away from there, and I thought, I feel worse than when I came in here. Really, because I owed the IRS. I owed every credit card company in North America. I owed my ex-wife money. I owed my boss money. And now I'm into Alcoholics Anonymous for $3. Where's the bottom to this pool? And I just keep going down. And I went out for coffee with them, and then I came back the next week because Debbie was going to get a chip. Which I sure didn't want to miss a chip. And she told me, you know, Charlie, she let me hold the chip after she got it. And she said, you know, if you stay sober for 30 days, you'll get a chip and a hug. I thought, oh, well, a chip and a hug. I hate people. I'm pissing blood. I can't sit still in my car. I forgot how to walk 2 weeks ago. I need a hug, you know. Can somebody come up with a 5 or a 10? Something. Just a little scratch. A hug is nice, but keep it to yourself. Don't touch me. You know? My friend Eileen W. says she came into AA and she was saying, help. And I think I understood that completely. Help me. I'll do anything you want. As long as I agree with it. And so I got the book, and then they said, you got a sponsor yet? Why? Well, I know I'm being led into a trap. Why do I need a sponsor? Well, they'll walk you through the book. Walk me through this big book? Yeah, they'll help interpret it for you. Really? I've got a bachelor's degree in journalism and a minor in English literature. I've parsed some of the finest poetry and plays and writing in the English language. And to tell you quite honestly, I'm not terribly impressed with G. Ma, Ain't It Grand, The Wind Stop Blowing. And as much as I appreciate the offer, I don't know that I need somebody to help me unlock the mystery of the jaywalker analogy, you know? And thirdly, I don't give a damn about Mr. Brown. So why would you even want to tell me anything about him? But I eventually went to another group, and I got a sponsor. I went to the Pacific group at about 50 days sober, and I got a sponsor, not because I needed somebody to walk me through the book. I got a sponsor so you would shut up. So that when you said, hey, Charlie, you got a sponsor? This guy named Butch would come up every meeting. Hey, Charlie, you got a sponsor yet? No, Butch, you see, I don't need a sponsor because I've been reading the book and I do this. And meanwhile, he's walked away, you know. And they did that just to mess with me, you know. Hey, Charlie, you got a sponsor yet? And I would give them the story and they just walk away. So I got a sponsor so that I could say, yes, yes, I have a sponsor. That's him right there. Why don't you go ask him, you know. And I started to do what my sponsor told me to do. And the first thing he told me to do was get commitments at meetings, to treat the commitments like a job, to be at meetings every day, to call him every day, to get to the meeting an hour early, and stay afterward and go to coffee with people. Walk around and shake people's hands and ask them their name. You have got to be kidding. What is this? Are we going to sing Kumbaya later on? This is twisted. I don't care. How are they asking their names going to help? This is not the Rotary Club. I mean, this is weird. I went around and, hi, I'm Charlie. And they'd say something like, I'm Jeff. And I'd, oh, so it's Jeff, is it? It took me about 3 months before I would shake hands without having my elbow locked, just to keep you away. And I didn't like you. I did not like you. I just felt guilty because I thought, I'm different from you. I'm not like you, and I'm not going to get better like you. This is a simple program for simple people, and I'm a complicated guy, and I need a more complicated program. My sponsor would just tell me, shut up and just do what I ask you to do. So, okay. So I go do it. I never tell him that because I didn't want him to not like me. And I needed a spiritual awakening, though, and I kept hearing people talk about, you know, I did the steps, and I was working on the steps, and working the steps, and working the steps, and I'm working the steps, working the steps. I thought, well, how do you work the steps? You know, somebody helped me work the steps. I went to Bill and said, how do I work the steps? I'm 6 months sober, and I'm not working any steps. And he goes, really? Which steps do you think you're not working? I said, well, the first three might be a starter. And he said, are you calling me every morning? Yeah, you know that. You're at the meetings every night because I see you here, yeah. You get your commitments here, right? Yeah. You're going out for coffee every night because I go out for coffee with everybody and you're there. Yeah, I go out for coffee. You getting people's phone numbers? Yeah, I'm calling people every day and I get their phone numbers and I talk to them and I ask them their name and stuff. He said, which part of the first three steps do you think you're not working? They're a lot more complicated and a lot more action-driven than just theory. It's not how well you can talk about them. It's what you're doing. Nobody cares about your concept of a higher power. They just want to know that you're doing godly things. What godly thing? You know, and he said, listen, I can't explain it to you, but it'll happen for you. Just trust me that if you keep doing it, something is going to happen for you. And I thought, well, that's, you know, I don't believe it. I mean, it's good for you because it happened for you and it happened for them, but it's not going to happen for me. I don't know why. I don't know why it's not going to happen for me. I still have a lot of fear about this. One time he called me and he told me to say my prayers while he was on the phone in the morning. And I thought, oh, God, you know, okay, just get off the phone and say your prayers. So I put the phone on the bed, got down on my knees, and I said my prayer. And I'd heard, see, I want a big spiritual experience. And I would say my prayer, and it's pretty much the same prayer I say today. God, please help me do your will today. I say the seventh-step prayer, and I say the third-step prayer. And I ask God, please help me do your will today. Please help me to be useful to people who need my help. Please help my friends who need your grace in their lives, whether they're sick or they have need, whatever that is. Please bring peace in the world. And if you're going to tell me your will, please be really, really obvious, because I'll miss it if you don't tell me what it is really obviously. Do not be the still small voice. I don't get it. I don't get still small voices. I don't get subtlety. I need something big, you know, something grand, not some piddly little thing. I need you to shake me by the lapels like a John Donne kind of a surrender, you know, slap me around, who's your daddy kind of a surrender. I don't need some little there kind of thing. And so I would say my prayers and get on the phone, and Bill would say, I'll see you at the meeting tonight. And I'd go do my work, and I'd go to the meeting. One night at 8 months sober, I was standing at my meeting. I tell this every time I talk because it's the most important moment of my sobriety. I stood at this meeting, at the end of the meeting, and I was with these two other losers who were still sober, and all three of us are in the same, we got sober at the same time, we're all mop guys, because that's what we Irish are built for, and so I'm mopping the floor, you know, and we're mopping up the meeting after it's over, and I thought, great, you know, I'm getting spiritual now, I'm mopping it up, and I looked, and the people were lined up to thank the speaker, and there were about 125 people in line, and I paused for a second, I'm holding onto the mop, and I took a breather for a second, and I looked at these people, and my eyes went right across their faces like this as I was looking at them. And it hit me. I know everybody in that line by name. And I like them. I like them. And if you were to allow me to go anywhere else right at this moment, like you would send me anywhere else I wanted to go in the world right now, I wouldn't take it, because I want to feel this way as long as I can. You know, and it only lasted a few seconds, but I thought, whoa, what was that? And I told Bill about it the next day, and he said, you had a moment of grace. You had a moment of grace. That's a spiritual awakening. You finally got out of your way long enough for God to make an appearance. Because he doesn't come down from heaven on a cloud and throw lightning bolts on you. He lives inside. That's my interpretation of God. That's, you know, you'll get, as however many people are in this room, that's how many interpretations of a higher power you get, because it's an individual relationship. My God, I believe, is inside. And when I am able to let go of everything, he can get out. He's always been in there. That's why I've been so restless, irritable, and discontented all my life, because I keep shoving him in the back and thinking that I know what is best for me and how to do it. And everybody in this room, you know, there's probably 200 people in here, 250 people. And every single one of us has something that our Creator, whoever you believe that to be, has imbued in each of us that we do better and differently than anybody else. And if we don't use that, those gifts, we'll never be able to have any kind of a relationship with God. And part of those gifts to me was learning how to talk to other alcoholics and how to be useful in AA. Once I was able to be useful in a way that I didn't even believe would be spiritually helpful, then I was able to understand that usefulness is a subtle thing. You know, you find out as you do it, not as you think about it. And I had, at that point, a God of my understanding rather than a God of my expectations, which I came into AA with. And I felt like my life had turned a corner then. And I've had that experience over and over and over again, usually with the guys I sponsor, with the good people I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and through all the challenges that sobriety brings, because you're sober doesn't mean that you're immune from life as it happens. That life goes on and you get hurt. And we're not, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we are so out of step with modern times, because everybody's a victim in modern times. And in AA, they just tell you, suck it up and play. You know, you got to play injured sometimes. You know, life is tough. Wear a cup. That's what I heard somebody say once. And some days are good, and some days you get, you know, the old Lou Groza kick right in the groin, and it's painful. But it doesn't mean that God has left me. It just means that it's something I have to turn to him for. And I have to take spiritual actions to get that. It's not that I have to sit there and go, oh God, please make the rain stop, because that's not what he's there for. It's more like, oh God, please help me accept the rain and do something for the people that are around me, if that's possible. And you show me, because I'm no good at judging what I'm going to do. If I have to sit around and pick what I'm going to do, I'll be here forever. I did that for the first 30 years of my life and tried to cherry pick what I was willing to do. And here you just say, well, I know what you want to do, but just go stack the chairs for now. I know what you want to do, but you better answer the phone because one of the guys you sponsor is calling and he needs to talk to you. And they always call at the bad time. They'll always call just at that. You know, they used to, when I had TV service, they'd always call me right at that point when NYPD Blue was going to have a turn in the story. And then the phone would ring, and she broke up with me. And I thought, great, you know, she's been going with you for 7 years. She breaks up with you tonight when I'm trying to watch this. Right now, she broke up with you. But I'll tell you what happened. You know, and I've been through, in my sobriety, I was taught to go, my sponsor said, I had to start spending more time with my mother. Now, my mother and I had a really difficult relationship because I know she didn't approve of me, even though she lent me all the money that I needed. I know my father didn't, but he died before I got sober. And I waited to make amends to them. And then I was listening to Clint one time talking about making amends to his mom who had died. And I was by my dad's cemetery where my father was buried. I hadn't been there for 20 years. And I went and I got some paper towels and some Windex and some scissors and a carnation because he liked carnations. And I went over to the cemetery and I went to his grave and did exactly what Clint describes. Followed his what he did exactly, his example. And what happened was that I talked to my dad and told him that what I'd found. I was 10 years sober at the time. I waited a long time. I put that amends off for a long time after my sponsor told me to make it. And I talked to him and told him I'd found you. I told him what I was doing. I told him that people in AA had taught me that the things that he had been trying to teach me were right. And I thanked him for that because I was in good hands and things were going better for me. And I knew that he would be happy for that. And then I went away and nothing happened. I left that cemetery and drove home and I didn't have any burst of shaft of light through the clouds or anything. But a couple of months later, I was talking to someone about my father and I didn't feel guilty inside. And I didn't feel like he'd been disappointed in me at all. My mom had 4 babies and 3 of them died at birth. And I was the one that survived. I was the one who put all the expectations on myself and felt disappointed in me. It wasn't my dad. It wasn't my mom. They loved me. They just couldn't deal with a son who couldn't love back and who didn't understand what that meant, you know. And I made amends to my mom by being a son for her. This is a woman who wouldn't let me in her house unless she was there, you know. I'd broken in one time and I was drunk and I woke up the next morning in her nightgown. But that's another evening. Anyway, this is a woman who had put up with a lot from me, from the projectile vomiting on PCP to just about having my head twist around on its axis in her presence. And so after I'd made amends to my dad, I felt comfortable enough in my relationship with my mom after I'd listened to Sharon B. talk about paying her dad back the money that she had taken from him. I paid my mom back in the same way. And then I had a relationship with my mother after a couple of years of doing the things that people had asked of me. So I went to make amends to my mom. Now my dad, I'll tell you the story that I'm going to sit down because I know I've gone a little long. I sponsor guys. I do inventories up to this date. I try to be a better dad to my son. I've just been through a couple of raw years. And a woman, Julie C., who lives in Tejon Pass in L.A. area, says that she laughs, not laughs, but she chuckles when she hears someone new say that I stay sober no matter what. Because at 30 days, you haven't got any idea how deep the pool of no matter what can get. No matter what can be a really terrifying place, especially the longer you're sober, when you feel like you don't know how to change and how to face certain situations. And I got married and was in love and had 2 babies, and then we got a divorce, partly my fault, partly my wife's fault, whatever it was. I'm not laying any blame now because, you know, she needs you as much as I do. And I hope that she finds somebody here, and I'm not going to diss her from a podium because somebody in this room may somehow wind up helping her someday, and I don't want to muddy the pool at all. But it destroyed me inside. I mean, just devastated me when I had to leave that family. And people in AA came out of the woodwork. I had offers to come stay at somebody's house. I lived at her house for 3 months and in her guest house. And and was able to kind of get my act together there. And then I got my own apartment, and then I started piecing my life back together. But I couldn't move for about 2 years. I had people offering me antidepressants. I had doctors offering me to write me scripts for, you know, antidepressants and other stuff. And I just thought, you know what, I have no opinion about that at a public level, but I'll tell you something. I think I would rather try to do the steps first and see what happens. And I was in a pit. I mean, I was in a pit of despair. And I had people, single divorced dads who told me how to be a good dad to my kids, even though I wasn't living in the house, and how to be consistent with them and how to love them. That's why I brought my phone in here tonight. I had to go in and call my children before they went to bed, because they're 6 and 4, and they count on me to call them every night. They get upset when I don't call them. You know, I called and said, I'm in Portland, Oregon now. And my daughter says, are you still on an airplane? I said, no, I'm on the ground now. And, you know, they just don't get it, but they love to have me call. And I learned that from AA guys and from the guys I sponsor. You know, they saved my life for 2 years. They would call me with their problems, and I forgot about my own. For 2 years, they were sponsoring me, and they didn't even know it, and pulled me through. And my friends pulled me through. And I just continued to do the stuff that I was taught to do when I was new. And my dad, I know a lot about AA love because I have been the recipient of so much of it that I will never be able to pay it back. You just learn to live with that and you do what you can. But my father used to get up every morning from the time I was in about the 7th grade to the 10th grade, and he would make a sandwich for me. Now, my parents had no resources whatsoever. But my dad would get up and he'd make a sandwich, and he would put chips in the bag and put it in there, and he'd put cookies in a bag and stick it in there, or fruit or something, and he'd fold it up and put my name on it and set it by the front door, and he'd go off to work at McDonnell Douglas. Never missed a day, as I recall. My father was never sick. He went to that job. He didn't love his job, but he went there every single day. And I would get up, and I'd grab that lunch, and I'd go to school, and as I crossed the property line of school, I'd throw it in the trash can and just keep walking, because cool kids don't carry their lunch. Cool kids buy their lunch. And if my parents really loved me, they would give me money to buy my lunch so I wouldn't be humiliated, because I already know I'm a loser anyway. I don't need one more piece of evidence to show people, oh, look, I've got my lunch too. What a dork, huh? You know? So I'd throw it in the trash. And every time I did that, I didn't realize it at the time, but it twisted, like Clancy talks about, that little screw inside your gut. It just tightened it one little micrometer each time I did that, so that when time had passed, I couldn't even look my dad in the eye. I didn't really have a relationship with him. I was guilty around him, and I felt that he was judging me, and he was disappointed in me, blah, blah, blah. So that happened for years. So I went to tell my mom, make amends. I made amends to my mom, but after I'd come to this revelation about my father, I sat down with my mom, and I said, you know, I used to throw my lunch away every day when I go to school, when Dad would make it for me. And she said, I know. And I said, how do you know? And she said, well, your dad told me. I said, how did he know? She said, well, he used to ask you how your lunch was, and you'd always give him the wrong answer. He would ask you from time to time, how was the apple today? I'd say, it was great, and it was an orange. Or how was your peanut butter and jelly sandwich? And I'd say, it was terrific, and it was bologna or something. And I'd always give him the wrong answer. And he didn't ask very often. He just every so often would ask me, how is it today? I was terrific, perfect, Dad. And he knew that I was throwing it away. And I looked at my mom and I said, because I was stunned. And I said, why did he keep making lunch for me if I was throwing it away? And she looked at me across the kitchen table and she gave me that mother smile. And I got it. Like that, I got it. He loved me. That's why he made my lunch every day and kept making it. It didn't matter to him what I did with my lunch. It just mattered that he could make it for me to demonstrate his care for his son. My mom said, when you were born, your dad went around the neighborhood with a bottle of bourbon and 4 glasses and stopped at every house on the block and said, come on, let's have a drink. My wife had a baby today, you know, and he was delighted that I was in his life. Never understood that. Just kept throwing the lunch away. And who missed the nutrition? I did. He didn't. That's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous love is about. It's dry-eyed humility. It has no concern for what comes back from it. It's just what is the action of doing it. People came here tonight and set up the sound and made coffee and set up the chairs. People were leaving dinner early to come over here and missing the fellowship of dinner to come join the fellowship of setting this meeting up so that people would have a place for a newcomer to walk in and have the message of Alcoholics Anonymous come, not from this podium, but from the interaction with other alcoholics who love this program. And if you don't want it, new people, that's okay. We're still going to keep making the lunch for you. We're still going to keep putting it out there. If you don't want to take it today, that's okay, because it'll be here next week. We're not going to stop making it because you don't want it. We'll keep making it until you do want it. We will not love you until you can love yourself. We'll love you until you, too, can learn to love other people through your actions and through what's going on in this program and through the absolute intercession and power of a creator that I believe wants all the best for everybody in this world, and we're the ones who are lucky enough to stay with that and to stay here and to be able to have the luxury of a good cup of coffee and some fellowship and some sobriety and not have to live like we did before. And again, I want to thank Chris for having me, and God bless. Thanks.